The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 12th of November, 2020. On the podcast today, Nick Dashwood-Brown, Head of Investor Relations at Anexo, talks about their new major shareholder and provides a trading update. Also on the podcast, George McDonough, Managing Director and Co-Founder of KR1, explains how they're receiving decent revenue at zero costs from staking activities on the Kusama network. Also, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers news from the following companies: WH Smith, Burberry, ITV, and Rolls-Royce. And at the end of the podcast, as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most like and most read RNSs. You can see both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. You can see both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you can also see our COVID-19 index, which, let's have a look, biggest rise of the day is, Symphony Environmental for a second there, but it's not, it's Novacyt, up 10%, 872. Biggest fall of the day is Amica Diagnostics Group, and that's down 15% to 47.50. Okay, check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk. We'll also see lots of other content, articles, blogs, videos, podcasts. Check it out.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Nick Dashwood-Brown, Head of Investor Relations at Anexo. ANX is the ticker there. Nick, thanks for joining me.
Hi, good morning. Nice to see you.
Yeah, now you've released some news there, an acquisition of shares and a trading update, and we'll get into that in a bit. Before we do, Nick, if someone's listening and they've never heard of Anexo, could you just summarise what the business is about, please?
Sure. Anexo is a one-stop shop that looks after non-fault victims of road traffic accidents. And there are two parts to our business. If you're involved in a road traffic accident, we provide you with a replacement vehicle, which you have for the period while your vehicle is being repaired or until you get a check for the write-off of the vehicle from the other side's insurance company. And the other part of the business is our legal services group, which pursues the insurance company to be reimbursed for the cost of the repair, or for that matter, the write-off, and also claims associated legal costs, including, where appropriate, personal injury. And we specialize in what we call the impecunious market. And these are people who don't normally have access to a replacement vehicle. They don't have the financial wherewithal to provide themselves with another vehicle, nor are they able to go to a hire company. So without us, they're on the bus.
Okay, got it. Absolutely. So let's start off with the acquisition of shares by DBay. Who are DBay, Nick?
DBay is a private equity firm. They are based in the Isle of Man and in London. They manage money on behalf of a range of institutions, pension funds, foundations, family offices, and so on. So they're very, very widely spread, and they have a great deal of experience in the private equity space. We're very happy to have them.
Yeah, and why have they taken a stake then?
Well, they're value investors, and I think they've had a look at us and recognised that we are undervalued by the market. I think they feel that clearly they can add some value to it. You'll see under the terms of the deal that when the deal is completed, it's being done in two tranches. They will have the right to appoint up to three non-executive directors to the board. And clearly they believe they can add value both in terms of expertise and potentially in terms of extra resources for the company.
Excellent stuff. Okay. And will they be injecting further funds?
Well, I think we will have to see how things transpire. At the moment, it's a straightforward equity purchase, so they're ending up as a major shareholder. Mm-hmm. I think we raised some money earlier on this year from the public equity markets, and we are a growth business. I'm sure at some stage there may come a time where we would be looking to invest more in the business, and that's presumably a conversation we'll have at that stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go on to the trading statement you released as well, of course. Everything's been affected by COVID, but take us through exactly what's happening and in relation to new referrer garages, what's happening there?
Well, I don't think that anybody can be called a winner out of the COVID pandemic, but we are fortunate fortunate in some ways because both our businesses, the credit hire side and the legal services side, are essential businesses under government guidelines. So we have remained open throughout. We remained open during the first lockdown and we remained fully open during the second lockdown. The credit hire business continues as was. We continue to put vehicles on the road for those people involved in road traffic accidents. And, you know, despite a potential decline in traffic, it's amazing that people are still finding ways of running into each other. On the legal services side, the courts remain open by telephone or by Skype where necessary. So our legal people are continuing to settle cases and thereby collect cash from the insurance companies.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And what does this mean for vehicles on the road, Nick?
Well, it's interesting. We've seen a big increase in vehicles on the road recently. When lockdown first came in March, then vehicle numbers went down quite sharply, as you would expect. You may recall back in March that the roads were more or less deserted. And then the numbers started creeping back up again. Even in this second lockdown, we're still seeing a considerably higher number of vehicles on the road. And, you know, that's a trend which is going to continue. Mm-hmm. We have a stat which is average number of vehicles on the road over the course of a year. And we said in the trading statement that this year, that number will be larger than last year, despite lockdown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what's happening with VW? Explain when I say that. What's the significance of this?
Sure. So some of your listeners may have heard of the VW emissions case, which is basically a lawsuit, a group action, which has been brought against Volkswagen AG and their subsidiary models around, this was a cheat device which they put in their diesel engines to suggest that their emissions were less and therefore less harmful than they actually were. Now, Volkswagen lost a case in the Court of Appeal recently and they were refused permission to appeal against it. And they've actually reached settlements in a number of other national jurisdictions, the US, Brazil, and Australia, just to give three examples. So ultimately, we are acting on behalf of a number of claimants who had Volkswagen between two specific dates, who are entitled, in our view, to compensation for the fact that they were sold a vehicle which didn't do what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, okay. And in terms of the number of claimants we've got, we're in the trading statement, we've made it clear that we're continuing to attract claimants to this. I mean, I think our number is a little over 13,000 at the moment, and that is something that's being added to steadily. We have a social media campaign which continues to attract claimants. We vet them just to make sure that they're appropriate, and we believe that in the relatively near future, this case will either potentially go to court or, in our view, more likely, will lead to a settlement with Volkswagen.
Excellent stuff. Okay. Well, Nick, every day on the podcast, I highlight the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets. To get on that list, of course, people have to hit the follow button on your page. So give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Nexo and add you to their watch list, please.
I think, firstly, we are undervalued by the market. We remain very cheap on a PE and cash flow basis. Number two, nobody else does what we do. It is a big market in terms of the impecunious driver who's involved in accidents. We are roughly 2% of that market, but there isn't anybody else who does what we do in terms of scale, especially with the number of referrer or introducer garages which we have. And thirdly, we've just announced a major new shareholder. This is a private equity firm with a huge amount of experience in the small cap market. We believe they're going to be very good for us and they'll be very good for the share price.
Excellent stuff. Nick, it's good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll chat in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Look forward to it. Thank you. Cheerio.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is George McDonough, Managing Director and Founder of KR1. George, you all right, fella?
Yeah, great, thanks.
You must be quite good. I mean, I'm looking at the price of Bitcoin here. It's literally at... it's what, close to $16,000. It's above the previous spike it had in June 2019. And even if we scroll back, you know, it's now, if you look at a weekly chart, it's settling at a higher level than it did in that previous massive spike. Because when it got up that sort of 20,000, it sort of almost touched 20,000, came quickly back down. But now, even though it's had a rise quite drastically of late, it's looking a bit more sustainable, don't you think?
Yeah, exactly. It's very exciting times to see it, yeah, as you say, stay fairly stable at above 15,000.
And this time, I suppose, yeah. This time it's got more, like I said, Bitcoin itself has got more adoption amongst bigger money, isn't it? The institutions and all that stuff, you know, they're realizing it's an asset. They want exposure to one of the best performing assets in the last 10 years, and they're getting it. And so that is a lot more sticky money, isn't it, you know?
Absolutely, and it's a trend that we're seeing more of now. And you know, for every public company that's mentioning that they're, you know, putting it in their treasuries, there's probably a few others that aren't mentioning it. And I think that's a lot to do that, combined with the PayPal news, you know, is probably a lot of the reasoning behind the strength in the current price.
Yeah, that was PayPal news is huge, isn't it? Because let's be honest, there's a lot of people who know about Bitcoin. I mean, obviously you're in the center of the cryptocurrency world, so it's your world. But a lot of people to Bitcoin, they sort of may have heard of it, but they don't really know how to accumulate it in any way. But there's a lot of people, a lot more people have PayPal. And when that sort of mainstream market, you know, crosses over with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, then there's going to be a bigger adoption amongst the mass population, isn't there? You know,
that's certainly a possibility. Yeah, it was huge news for the entire ecosystem, really. And we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about the revenue from the Kusama staking yields. Now I think, what the heck is that about? But before we do that, it's cryptocurrency. Just explain to people who've never heard of KL1, just in a couple of lines, what you're about, if you could, George.
Sure. Yeah. So we're an early stage blockchain and digital investment company, and we support decentralized networks and open source blockchain projects. And then we also have another area of the business that's forming, which is called our staking activities, where we derive revenue from our holdings, and that sort of plays into today's announcement a bit.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, so according to that announcement, this holding came at zero cost. Yeah, it's very valuable. Can you explain how that works? I mean, everyone's taught, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch here, but I suppose you've put the hours in, so you deserve it. But how has it come at zero cost? What is it worth?
So Polkadot was one of our largest investments as a company, and very often what these protocols have to do is they have to create a kind of test network, so that a lot of the technology they're producing can be tested in a it's not so much a sandbox, but like an area where mistakes can happen, let's say, and then they can iterate and learn. And this has been something that's been around since the early Ethereum days, and Ethereum's got a range of test networks. And when Polkadot started its formation as a protocol, they created a network called Kusama, which is the sort of term for it is canary network, in the sense that you can test things and see how they run, and then gradually sort of bring them over to the more secure network, which would be Polkadot. But because of the way Polkadot's designed, and because of how in effect it's a more secure platform, simply because of the amount of value in the tokens, it's also a very expensive place to connect your blockchain to, potentially. All this is still yet to play out, but there is an element where Kusama actually will have a entire ecosystem to itself of projects that don't require moving up, sort of uplisting to Polkadot, as it were. And so therefore the test tokens that we got given as part of our holdings that we have in the Polkadot token, the DOT token, and we got these given to us one for one for free, the market has realized that actually there is value in this test network, because there's going to be an ecosystem that grows out of it, sort of outside of just the Polkadot network. And that's why, we got them for free, but it's also now why they're actually worth, considerable value. And it's a quirk of the crypto world, really, that over time these test networks can actually gain value independently.
Yeah, well, it's a nice quirk to have. And roughly, can you say what they're worth at the moment?
Well, we've got a holding of 40,270. Obviously it changes over time, but I think that's worth in today's market about $1.5 million. And then on top of that, Kusama tokens are very similar to DOT tokens in a way. Yes, the DOT tokens were redenominated, so in terms of number, they're different. But you can stake them in the network. That's how the security of the network is formed. It's through participants such as ourselves locking away our tokens in the network in order to derive a yield. It's a bit like Bitcoin mining, but instead of having plugging in electronic machines into the wall to hash through the functions. Instead, what you do is you lock away collateral. And so, not only did we receive this amount of tokens into our portfolio, but we're also staking those tokens. And over the past year, we've created an income of over $100,000 on that position. So not only was it free, not only is it valuable, but we're also making, significant revenue from that position. And it's going to be exciting to see how this network performs alongside Polkadot, which of course we also have a significant holding in. So it's really fascinating to see how this will play out.
Yeah. And you get this one, so it's a yield, isn't it, you get? And so that's how it works.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's a yield in the native Kusama token. So we receive more Kusama tokens at a defined rate, depending on how many of these tokens are staked in the network. So it's a sliding scale. It changes over time, which is why it's very difficult to sort of give definitive future criteria in terms of what the revenue would look like, but certainly, yeah, it's hugely material to the company. And of course, it joins a basket of other staking assets. Of course, we've been staking Cosmos for close to 2 years, and obviously we put out a few announcements recently on the staking that we're doing with Polkadot. And together, these assets form a solid pipeline of revenue to the company, and that's incredibly useful for a young investment company such as ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, do you have any other investments where you're staking, George?
Well, yes. So, like I just mentioned, there is always more coming to the market. Staking is a sort of key element of new parts of this blockchain ecosystem that are expanding outwards. It started with Bitcoin and proof of work and proof of stake, which is the underlying mechanism that secures these networks, is something that we at KR1 decided very early would be something that we would go after, and hence our investment into Cosmos in 2017. And so because of that has been our focus, the portfolio has now built up a range of holdings that have this aspect to them. Being an investment company, but also moving into becoming a staking company, is very much part of the strategy. And so we're staking Polkadot, we're staking Cosmos, we're staking Kusama. There's the possibility that Definity will come online later next year, and that would also be added to that basket. And there are a range of others, not forgetting, of course, Ethereum itself, which is moving into a proof of stake. In fact, even as we speak, the lights are being switched on in Ethereum 2.0, should we say, and that's also hugely exciting for us and the rest of the space.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned it before when you come on, and I suppose it's still there, but there's a buzz about the concept of decentralized finance, or DeFi. So how are you involved in this? How are you capitalizing on this, George?
Well, yes, DeFi is a sort of umbrella term that appeared around a range of projects on Ethereum that really we'd been investing in all along without the umbrella. We were just interested in decentralized finance applications that were beginning to show. So we've been investing in DeFi projects since day one, really. I mean, our very first major significant investment into the space was into a project called, at the time, Melonport, which is a sort of decentralized hedge fund mechanism that basically allows you to create modules together that produces a hedge fund on chain, which is the very sort of, you know, crux of DeFi, really. And then since then, we backed projects like Argent, which is firmly in that category as a sort of on-ramp to DeFi. And then our sort of, you know, shining star of DeFi investments, of course, is Nexus Mutual, which allows, you know, which is a cover mutual that allows people to take out cover on smart contracts, which are, of course, the sort of the underlying fabric of DeFi itself. And because this is a young industry, there are, you know, smart contracts aren't always designed in ways that the designer expects them to function, and of course, when they're holding, you know, very significant sums of value, something like Nexus Mutual that allows people to take cover out on these smart contracts has just found amazing product market fit for us, really. And we knew they would. We knew that over time, the market would understand the importance that this particular project has. So really, DeFi is in our blood, has been since day one, and you know, we're really beginning to feel the benefits of having you know, followed this track early and made some significant investments in that area.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's going very well by the sounds of it. And and, you know, are there opportunities like this one just now? I mean, is there more like that out there?
Yeah, so part of the ICO boom in 2017, what was really underlying that, when you take away all the froth and the noise, is actually the need to distribute tokens to a dispersed marketplace geographically. Like, you need to have token holders in order to have these decentralized networks float, to make them work. You know, if you think about Bitcoin being a token, Bitcoin, the network works because there is this unit of value that moves around the system. And these other networks are just the same. They require these tokens. And so what happens in this newer world, we've moved on from the ICO world, is that we have these new token distribution mechanisms that aren't really ICOs at all. They're not selling tokens to the public. What they're doing is they're rewarding community participants for participating in the network. And what you do is you signal your participation by locking up tokens. Potentially, there's lots of different ways that you can do it. I mean, Kusama, for example, was an airdrop. We got that just for having Polkadot tokens. But there's a range of different experiments that are happening whereby projects are distributing tokens to participants for free, or sometimes for what's thought of as an opportunity cost. So, you know, I might lock up some tokens, as we did with Plasm that we announced, which was another holding the vase. And what you do is you lock up tokens for a period of time, and so you're effectively getting the opportunity costs of locking up those tokens is the cost. You get those tokens back after a year or 6 months or however long you decide you want to lock your tokens up, and in return you get this you know, holding of tokens in that particular project. And it's a way of sparking a community, it's a way of sparking interest, but it's also a way of distributing tokens. And Polkadot is right at the very heart of that in terms of its design. So yes, we do expect, with our Kusama holding and our DOT holding, we do expect to see much more of that. Indeed, a lot of the projects on Polkadot are kind of mirroring their systems on Kusama. And so, you know, projects like Akala, which is already an investment of ours on Polkadot, they're now producing a similar infrastructure on Kusama. And, you know, they've already announced that there's the possibility that, you know, there would be tokens available for people who've already got a Kala token. So it's where this particular area of crypto is going. It's very exciting, especially when they you know, get considerable value.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're benefiting from that. Marvelous stuff, George. Well, listen, as always, if someone's listening to this right now, likes the sound of what you're talking about, and lots of people are following you, as you are, I suppose, you know, one of the easiest ways to get exposure to the cryptocurrency market. And but if they are listening right now, not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Sure. Well, yeah, the first reason you just touched on. If you're interested in crypto, then we do the hard work that finds you the exposure into the sort of the best up and coming projects that are coming down the line. I guess, secondly, you know, with a 4-year track record now of successful investment, the plan is to continue to deliver those results. You know, thirdly, the joys of being a UK resident, you can put our stocks in an ISA, which, you know, when one thinks about the crypto world, that could play out very nicely.
Excellent, sir. George, good to chat to you as always, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of financialorbit.com. All right, Chris?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. Very well. Well, it's been busy and, well, obviously rampant at a certain level on the financial markets. Obviously, good news on potential vaccines. Let's see how all of that works out. But clearly at the margin, good news, and clearly lots of market rotation as a consequence in terms of some of those out of favor sectors.
Absolutely.
Becoming a bit more in favor.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I'm going to do a video this week, and I'm going to highlight this. And I think that vaccine news was a tide change, you know, a sea change. I mean, what I'm saying is all the hot stocks, and there's a lot of stocks done really well. These are the COVID sort of testing stocks done very well, and a lot of people done really well at them recently. But that vaccine news came out, and all of a sudden, the bombed out stocks like travel, hospitality, leisure, all that kind of thing, flipped, and they did a massive rally on that day with the vaccine day. It was announced, Pfizer announced that. And I think Now that's going to continue to happen. We're going to get more positive news on vaccines coming out. And every time they come out, we're going to go back to the old hammered stocks that you say. I think people should now start taking, on down days, good companies that have been hammered, or leisure companies, any of these companies, and take positions in them. Because I think over the next 6 months, they're going to rally almost back to their previous highs. I mean, let's be honest, we know the stock market operates at what, a year, 12 months, 18 months ahead. So even though they may not get back to normality in 2022, I think they'll get back towards share price normality within the next 6-12 months. And so I just think that was a very telling move in the market when they announced, Pfizer announced that. You know, if you look at the sectors that dropped like a stone and the ones that rose quickly, and that's going to keep happening, I think. Because I don't know if you saw that, Dr. Fauci said pretty much this is good news for all the vaccines. They're all focusing on the protein element of the virus. And so they're reckoning Moderna's out, very similar technology to Pfizer. So I can't see anything but good news coming out. And I think, take some positions in some of these bombed out stocks, you know?
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, two things. Number one is I've been sort of glass half full for, you know, too long now. And the thing is, you've always got to back human ingenuity, because we wouldn't be top dog unless over time, you know, we found ways around problems. So, you know, I'm really pleased that the scientific community globally has made some advances. And, you know, clearly it's going to be difficult to distribute and all of those issues. We're not going to be queuing up outside our local doctor surgery for a number of months, you know, let's face it. But as you say, the market look forward, and 2021, 2022 have different angles now, which is clearly good. Yeah. Second aspect is, and this is sort of more from my historic world, is thinking what institutional investors are doing, because you're absolutely right. They have had skewed portfolios. You know, they've been underway sort of recovery sectors and value stocks, and overweight sort of working from home beneficiaries, tech stocks and related. To me, I'm really watching the bond market closely, because what will help induce that switch will be if you start seeing bond yields go up. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really kind of important insight. So keep half an eye on the bond markets, I would say, as well. For example, US Treasuries, 10 years, are they going to go above a 1% yield? I think they are over the next few weeks. That's a big thing. Same in the gilt market as well. So, you know, if bond yields go up, that encourages people again to look at financials and cyclicals and stuff like that. So, I mean, basically, the only thing to conclude is, if you're interested in the market, making a bit of money, you've got to pick stocks as always. If perhaps you're a bit more kind of passive, then embrace the tracker product. But for me, it's got to be stop picking that. That's going to be the route to success and interest and everything else over the next little while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? I had a friend of mine who's, and she's not an active investor, and she's in a Vanguard sort of fund, which is low cost, but it's not a tracker, but it's pretty much invested in the US, 20% of the US big stocks over there, like the Apples and all the techs, 20% over the UK, and developed countries around the world as well. And she asked me what to do, and I said, listen, it's up to you. You know, if you want to get a bit more involved, take a bit more risk on, but more reward if it plays out, is individual stocks. But I mean, you know, if just for you, if I were you, just passive, you know, investor like that, I just buy the dips in a tracker fund, that's it, and you can outperform any bank, you know, doing that all the time. Essentially, for people like that, who are very passive, don't care really, they're not into the market, I said, whenever you see these massive headlines pretty much on the main news and the markets have sold off, then it's time to top up a little bit, because over the long term you're fine, you know, and these things, but yeah, absolutely, stocks are where it's at. Right, okay, so stocks then is where it's at, Chris, so let's have a look at some stocks with news out. What's happening here?
Yeah, lots of things going on today. I mean, it's kind of interesting, something like WH Smith's, for example. WH Smith's, I mean, if you look at the numbers today, they look shabby. You would not invest in it because it's making a loss, because of course Smith's is not just the high street business that we all know, we've all kind of grown up with. Increasingly it's a travel business. You know, they've got their WH Smith franchise in an airport, at a train station or something like that. And many of those, we've talked about this before, particularly in the airports, it's a natural monopoly. You know, they're a wonderful sort of cash generator, but obviously so long as people are traveling. If they're not traveling, then they've obviously got a big problem. And that's what they've seen over much of the last year. They seem to be turning it around. They raised money early, so they've got their balance sheet in good nick. And obviously, news about a potential vaccine means that prospectively, the travel conditions potentially could start improving. You know, we're going to jump on a train or a plane or whatever with much more likelihood over the next year or so. So they're talking a sort of a positive turnaround story today. The static numbers look over, say, into a slight mild loss, but they're talking about recovery, improvement, coming off the bottom and everything else. And you can see the same in the shares. The shares were kicking around at 10 quid a share over much of the sort of the early summer period, you know, the immediate kind of lockdown one period. They did the money raising. They made sure their balance sheet was good. Shares are now up at about £14. But to put it into context, you know, this one was well above 20 quid a share a year ago, you know, pre-pandemic. So I think WH Smith is very indicative of that type of business where you've seen a bit of recovery. It's come off the bottom, but actually they're still, in terms of that gap between where they were pre-pandemic and where they are now, still a big old gap to fill. So as we've talked about already, these are the sort of names, decent franchises or a balance sheet, you know, natural monopoly or good at what they do inherently, which if you are optimistic about vaccines and a return to normality, that will actually continue to sort of grind up over the next years. So I thought supportive comments in preparation yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. But do you know what? That big day, vaccine day, 32% they rose. That to me says that's it, a sea change. The tide is coming back in for these stocks, you know, rather than going out. And it's almost like when a tide changes, you know, physically, you get one big wave coming in, and then all of a sudden that's where it stopped going out. And then it starts coming back in. I think right there, that day, vaccine day, Pfizer vaccine day, will be the change in the direction for these stocks. And like I said, Moderna's coming out with data this month, AstraZeneca not far afterwards. And so I think, of course, it doesn't go straight up. It'll come back a little bit, like tide, it'll go back out. But I mean, I think generally these stocks with good franchises, like you say, good stocks in these sectors will do well over the next 6 months. Cool, what's next, Chris?
Got to be Burberry next. Let's keep it in sort of the broad consumer space. So Burberry a bit different, of course. It's got now 30-40% of their business in China and the broader Asian geographic area. So clearly that sort of performed a bit differently, a bit better, frankly, over recent times. And obviously it's aiming to be higher end. It's not sort of a mainstream consumer shop, although a few people would like it to try to be that way, no doubt. So Burberry numbers today, again, nothing to shout about in terms of the sort of the year-on-year progression. They're still impacted by the legacy of sort of lockdowns and impacts and a cautious consumer. So you've got sort of revenues down 30-odd% for the half-year period, profits down around about 50%, depending on what precise metric you quote. But it's kind of interesting. Shares are up about 4% today when I last looked. And it's mainly for two reasons. Number one is they're talking about certain parts of the world still being good. So the aforementioned China, unsurprisingly, the States actually seems all right for them. And they're sort of happy and confident about future recovery in sort of Europe and places like that. Second reason, I think, though, is because they're talking about just slightly evolving their strategy a bit and actually saying we're going to do far fewer sort of markdowns, sort of sales and things like that. And I think that's actually quite smart. It will actually hurt them slightly, they said, in the short-term trading, because obviously you can use sales and markdowns and everything else to drive a bit of volume and people to, I was going to say, come into the store, but probably, you know, shop online, etc., with you now. But clearly, from a medium-term perspective, it's always better to be selling as much as you can at full prices with full margins and everything else. And certainly for a luxury company, there's no point in trashing your brand by, you know, trying to compete with a Primark or a mainstream clothing retailer by having, you know, special sales every other week or something. So I think that's probably one of the reasons the shares went up today. And again, a bit like WH Smith's, the Burberry shares are sort of in that kind of recovery mode. You look back a year ago, they were trading 20, 24 pounds, something like that, well over 20 pounds. They've kind of jumped off sort of 12, 13 pounds to sort of 16 pounds at the moment. But my feeling is branded company, big Asian exposure, that's an interesting combination. So I do like this one. I do actually own this one. I do think it's going back to 20 quid, to be honest.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Burberry. Cool. I think it was a Burberry hat. I didn't realise it was a Burberry hat. I bought a baseball cap the other day, but I think it was Burberry actually inside, but I didn't notice that. But there we are. So if they can come back on trend, Chris, I'm there. I'm in there. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Well, it's all about affording. I think, you know, you go back 10 years or so, obviously, we had the Burberry check was everywhere in a variety of consumer points. And they've sort of chugged on a bit since then. They've got sort of slightly different designs and are not kind of trying to sort of embrace that slightly broader market, you know, the mainstream market. And I think that's probably smart. Because let's face it, most people can be a mainstream retailer if they wish. You know, to be a higher end one is a bit harder. And clearly Burberry have got the legacy and the history and the focus and whatever else to be that. So yeah. We'll see.
Lovely stuff. Anything else, Chris, happening?
Quick one on Rolls-Royce, I think. I mean, they came up. You recall the story of Rolls-Royce. This is obviously Rolls-Royce, the aerospace, the defence company. You know, nothing to do with the cars, which were owned by Beamers, BMW, for many years now. So Rolls-Royce, as everyone knows, has had an absolute shocker in 2020. We all know the reasons why. If you've got in making the jets, servicing the jet engines and everything else, it's been a horror show, clearly, if people haven't been travelling. So Rolls-Royce, they had a slightly iffy balance sheet. Suddenly that became a big problem. They had to do effectively a bit of an emergency money raising. And we had the announcement today about how many shareholders took it up. A cool 94%. So 94% of shareholders, including myself, I have to say, took up the money raising, which makes, to me, perfect sense. What the other 6% thinking? Because the shares were a very big discount. And actually, they've been very strong performance over the last week on, obviously, hopes of getting the other side of the horrible pandemic issues, mainly because clearly they are very geared towards any recovery in travel and related. So this one's going to be particularly volatile and has been particularly volatile over recent months. But they've got the money raising away. They'll be very pleased about that. And let's see how it goes. But certainly Rolls-Royce shares are enjoying the fact that they've successfully raised that money to help shore up the balance sheet for the next little while.
Yeah. Excellent stuff. Marvellous. And anything else up there at all, Chris?
Well, a quick one on ITV then, which ITV shares are, again, they've been in a sort of a longer-term bit of a bear market. A lot of people call this stock cheap. And obviously, we know that TV is changing. We know ITV actually have been quite good, I think, in terms of some of that change. The ITV Studios business obviously can appeal to many different TV and related companies around the world have been chucking out some quite good stuff. But clearly the sort of the mainstream ITV1, ITV2 and whatever channels can get impacted by stuff like advertising trends moving around. That's what impacted them recently. And it's been tricky. And you could see that again in the numbers today. which frankly were a bit like W.H. Smith's numbers, the Burberry numbers were reflecting some of those challenges. But again, I kind of get the impression the shares have come off the bottom again in the last couple of months, and certainly will take talk about a vaccine and related better, because once again, what they desire, what they want, is a return to normality or pre-pandemic normality. They're not going to clearly get it perfectly. We know that the world, particularly of TV and media, is changing. But ITV actually, with their studios business, with BritBox and related, they're not terribly positioned for that sort of changing and evolving world. It's just more of a question of how big their company is going forward. So I thought actually a couple of supportive comments in terms of things such as advertising and stability and ultimately the studios business. It's still not easy for them, but again, the shares have come off the lows of sort of the late spring, early summer period, and a kind of rising up the water worry, I guess you would say. So I think really it's a big theme in today's chat, really. You know, you look at W.H. Smith, you look at Burberry, you look at ITV, you certainly look at Rolls-Royce. They're all kind of similar. They're all waiting, you know, a different kind of macro backdrop, vaccine-centred and whatever. And if that occurs, as we talked about already, active stock pickers should find something of interest in these names and others too.
Yeah. But ITV, I mean, I assume it's just advertising, some of that, but do you know what? From my children's perspective, they never, ever watch TV anymore. And I think that's sort of, it's a bit worrying. I know that ITV have an online presence, but my kids generally are on YouTube. I know they probably grow out of that a little bit, but that's all they look at. It's pretty people gaming on YouTube, or they want to play games. And I'm just thinking, I think the future for terrestrial TV is a bit bleak unless they can diversify some way, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think this is where ITV Studios becomes the key part of the business, because clearly you're producing content, original content, dramas, other shows, factual shows, whatever it might be, for consumption in a variety of locations. And that might be Netflix, that might be some American or European TV network or whatever. And I think that's undoubtedly the focus of the business. So that's, if you like, the shift that they've been doing for the last few years, to be honest. But you're right, you have to manage that decline. But this is where actually ITV, they're not horribly leveraged. Their balance sheet's in good nick. So that's always helpful. And as I say, on the terrestrial side, you can see the way it's shifting, hence why the sort of the hub, BritBox and related, is finding sort of ways to try to monetize that sort of content, those shows, in ways which consumers use to find them and access them today. I think something which has hurt them clearly has been the fact that Love Island, obviously for some sad reason, didn't quite work out the way they sort of hoped in terms of rolling out, and that's been a big generator of profit and interest for them. So yeah, it's certainly got some issues and challenges, but you look at the share price and you think, so you know, the only conclusion you can have is that they've come off the bottom. There's still a bit further to go, and I say my instinct would be the Netflix of this world are a bit overvalued, and the ITVs of this world are probably a bit undervalued. The truth's probably somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Marvellous stuff, Chris. Thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak you next week.
That's right. See you then.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They're at five on the market, up 4% to 105. I hold that, done a couple of videos on that. I think they're going to challenge Rightmove. I read it to you. At four, Verici DX, down 7.45% to 43.50. At three, Novacyt, up 10% to 8.71. Some directors buying stock there. At two, Alien Metals, non-mover 1.45 pence. And at one, Remote Monitored Systems, down 16%, 2.35. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. And info, let's look at the most read as well. Most read here is Amiga Diagnostics at one, response to media comment. Novacyt, director shareholding. At three, Horizonte Minerals, quarter financial results. At four, Powers Energy. At five, Remote Monitor Systems. And it's odd because some people like RNSs, but they're less popular or less well read, which doesn't make them any less worthwhile, of course, because I think you see when the herd is involved, doesn't mean it's a good stock. When you've got lots of people involved in one stock, who else is going to buy the stock off you? You know, everyone's bought. Okay, top five here. Powers Energy, Heads of terms agreed for license of DMG technology at 4, Arix to present at Jefferies Virtual London Healthcare Conference. At 3, KR1 revenue from Kusama staking yields. That's unbelievable. I thought that George took in. I don't hold KR1, but they are receiving free revenue, pretty much, and it's worth a bit of cash. That's very clever. At 2, Fast Forward Innovations, investee company update, Portage Biotech, and most liked, Legal & General. That is a new dividend, cash and capital ambitions. Check those out at voxmarkets.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.